Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. I hope you've been enjoying your President's Day weekend and all of this great sunny San Diego weather. Today, we'll be opening our show with a disturbing story about high levels of electromagnetic frequency radiation from the Sunrise Power Link that's been measured by experts through the heart of downtown Alpine, including around local schools. Could Alpine be the next Flint, Michigan, with a generation of children exposed to dangerous conditions? Learn more on today's show. A judge has issued a scathing order requiring the California Public Utilities Commission to release secret emails related to the shutdown of the San Onofre nuclear power plants. Hear what local legal experts for consumers have to say. On our Capitol Report, we'll have news about the battle brewing in Washington over the replacement of conservative Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, who died suddenly over the weekend. Learn what that could mean for cases pending before the High Court and for the long-term future of our nation on today's show. We'll also tell you about a challenge filed by prosecutors opposed to a parole initiative backed by Governor Brown. Plus, hear why San Diego Assemblywoman Lorena Gonzalez wants to give 16-year-olds the right to vote in school board elections. La Mesa has two community meetings planned this week to discuss the future of the city, and we'll tell you when and where you can come out to share your views. If you want to help scientists measure seismic tremors and receive a warning before a major earthquake strikes, now there's an app for that, and we'll have details. San Diego City Council has approved a minimum wage ballot initiative. Learn more on today's show. February is Heart Health Month, so today we'll have some tips for you on signs of a heart attack or a stroke and what you should do if you or someone near you is experiencing these symptoms. Plus, we have some good news. You can learn why San Diego has improved its heart health record compared to the rest of the nation. Our newsmaker interview today is with Don Axe from Valley View Urban Farm in Spring Valley. He'll be talking about his amazing results in raising crops and livestock, as well as making cheese, ice cream, soaps, and much more, all in his own small backyard. We'll also give you a sneak preview of some topics Don will be discussing on upcoming episodes of our show, when he'll be hosting our new Backyard Homestead series. Today, we'll also re-air our interview with Joyce Strand, author of a series of mystery novels set in Ramona's wine country. Then we'll have a weather report for you, and here's a hint, you can break out the swimsuits and flip-flops the next couple of days. We'll also tell you about a Santee man planning a walk across America to help patients with Lou Gehrig's disease. Then on Green Scene, hear about last week's Supreme Court decision to block President Obama's climate action plan. We'll also tell you how you can take SANDAG's new survey to share your views on priorities for transportation and other important topics for our region. Plus, learn about a possible strike by faculty members at California State University campuses coming up. So stay tuned for all of these stories and more on today's East County Magazine radio show, where East County matters. Before the Sunrise Power Link was built and buried through downtown Alpine, many residents voiced concerns about the possibility of exposure to electromagnetic field radiation, or EMFs, particularly since the line passed directly in front of the Alpine Elementary School and along the route of a proposed new high school, a route where children walk to school, a community center is located, a preschool, and the public shops and stores along Alpine Boulevard, the town's main street. Now, EMF levels along the route of the underground high-voltage line have been measured, and experts found dramatically higher levels than before the line was installed. High EMF levels have been linked to leukemia in children. Perhaps most disturbing, levels have shot up sixfold nearest the Alpine Elementary School, and even more at the proposed new high school site, far above levels considered dangerous, the Alpine Sun reports. Engineer Robbie Falker and contractor Michael Milligan conducted the study. In an editorial published in the Alpine Sun, they wrote, "We asked the Alpine Planning Group to ask the County of San Diego to examine the Alpine children for leukemia once a year as a precaution." Alpine Sun editor Lori Bledsoe indicated that she also walked the boulevard with an EMF meter, and she found the study's readings to be correct. A study by Oxford University and the Institute of Environmental Health in Sweden found that exposure to EMFs above 0.2 and 0.4 microtesla increased the risk of childhood leukemia. According to the British site PowerWatch, which has links to various scientific studies that it cites, there is now general acknowledgement that magnetic fields in excess of about 0.3 to 0.4 microteslas are linked with a doubling of leukemia. The article adds that some increase in leukemia was found from as little as 0.15 microteslas. Thus, the author concludes it is wise to minimize our exposure. Not all studies have been that conclusive, and the World Health Organization classifies EMFs as possible carcinogens. The local study in Alpine measured EMFs along Alpine Boulevard before the power link was buried and again after the line was energized. In addition, recent measurements were taken in a pickup truck at the same locations on Alpine Boulevard and also along Interstate 8, parallel to the boulevard. In every location along the boulevard, EMF levels were higher after PowerLink was energized, and many locations had readings well above the 0.2 danger threshold. The elementary school site's levels shot up sixfold from 0.07 before PowerLink to as high as 0.43 after. The high school site went from 0.3 to 1.44 in January 2016, measured on foot, and an astounding 2.04 microteslas measured from inside the truck along Alpine Boulevard. The highest readings were at the Putz Valley Road intersection, 2.12 measured from the truck driven on Alpine Boulevard. That's 10 times the potential danger level. Star Valley Road's readings skyrocketed from 0.1 to as high as 1.85 on average in January of this year. By contrast, the readings along Interstate 8, much farther away from the power link, had much lower readings, and all but one were well within the levels considered to be safe. The last was just barely over. The Alpine Community Planning Group condemned this project in strongly worded language to the California Public Utilities Commission, which ignored the community's concerns over PowerLink. The Public Utilities Commission has since faced corruption allegations, lawsuits, and a criminal investigation involving its overly cozy ties to the utility corporations that it regulates. Supervisor Diane Jacob fought against construction of the high-voltage line, which also passes through many other communities in East County. East County Magazine has reached out to SDG&E, which built the line, and to Supervisor Diane Jacob to ask if anything can be done to shield the underground line and protect the people of Alpine, especially the children. Other prominent politicians endorsed building Sunrise PowerLink, and some even took money from SDG&E or its parent company, Sempra Energy, while supporting the project. That includes State Senator Joel Anderson, who is now running for supervisor against Diane Jacob. Anderson was forced to pay a hefty fine in 2009 for violating campaign laws by taking more money from Sempra Energy than is allowed by state law, all while the approval process for the highly controversial PowerLink was ongoing. Construction of the line began in 2010 and was completed in June 2012. When regulatory agencies and elected officials fail to protect the public interest, the results can be devastating, as has been seen in Flint, Michigan, where a generation of children has suffered lead poisoning and permanent mental impairment from lead in the public water supply, all due to regulatory decisions made based on money, not public safety. Could Alpine be the next Flint, Michigan, with a generation of children who are now ticking time bombs to contract leukemia, blood cancer, or other illnesses linked to EMF exposure? Only time will tell. Meanwhile, concerned Alpine parents are watching, waiting, and hoping their elected representatives and state regulatory officials will take notice and do the right thing to protect the children of Alpine. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
A San Francisco Superior Court judge has ruled that secret emails between Michael Picker, the president of the California Public Utilities Commission, the governor's office, and Southern California Edison must be made public. In the past year, the Public Utilities Commission has spent millions on criminal defense attorneys to stonewall investigations into its employees who have allegedly engaged in criminal activities related to the $3.3 billion ratepayer-funded bailout of the failed nuclear generators at San Onofre. In a sternly worded ruling, Judge Ernest Goldsmith wrote, "To consider this merely an ordinary rate-setting regulatory matter would do violence to the right of citizens." According to utility fraud attorney Mike Aguirre in San Diego, this ruling is a bombshell. Aguirre's partner, Maria Severson, says, "This is a major breakthrough for the people of California. The doors to the trial court have been burst open to hear the people's concerns about those who decide in secret what they must pay in rates." Estimates of the average cost per ratepayer of the San Onofre bailout range from $2,300 to almost $3,000. San Onofre is just one of several major scandals involving the Public Utilities Commission recently. Others include the San Bruno pipeline explosion and the San Aliso natural gas leak. What can be done to make the PUC more accountable to the public? One possible solution is a ballot initiative proposed by Assemblyman Mike Gatto. If approved by voters, his initiative would break up the PUC and transfer its regulatory duties to other state agencies. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. This is Miriam Raftery with a Capitol Report. The sudden death of conservative Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia over the weekend leaves a vacancy on the High Court and a battle over his replacement. President Barack Obama has announced he intends to appoint a replacement and fulfill his constitutional duty. But Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has suggested that Obama leave nominating a new justice for the next administration since this is an election year. McConnell and other prominent Republicans have suggested that any appointment made by Obama would be blocked by Senate Republicans through a filibuster. McConnell's remarks are hypocritical since he voted for President Ronald Reagan's appointment of Justice Anthony Kennedy during an election year. After his appointment by Reagan, a Republican, Kennedy was confirmed by the Senate, which was then controlled by Democrats in a bipartisan action. Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid, a Democrat, has stated it would be unprecedented in recent history for the Supreme Court to go a year with a vacant seat. Failing to fill this vacancy would be a shameful abdication of one of the Senate's most essential constitutional responsibilities, Reid said. He's correct when it comes to the history books. Since 1900, there has not been a single case of the Senate refusing to confirm a presidential appointment to the Supreme Court in an election year due to the pending change of presidents. The stakes are high now for both sides in filling the void left by Scalia, but so are the consequences of leaving a seat vacant for nearly a year. According to the SCOTUS blog, a legal publication covering the Supreme Court of the United States, over the last century, Supreme Court nominations by Presidents William Taft, Woodrow Wilson, Herbert Hoover, Franklin Roosevelt, and Ronald Reagan were all confirmed in election years. And if you go back to the 1800s, another eight justices were seated in election years. Never has a Supreme Court justice position been left vacant until after an election. There has been just one case of a high court nominee not winning confirmation during an election year in the last century for reasons that had nothing to do with the upcoming election. But in that case, a Supreme Court justice had announced plans to retire, and he remained on the bench, so the court did not have a vacancy and could not deadlock on cases even though President Lyndon Johnson's nominee was not confirmed. Justice Scalia was found dead Saturday at a private ranch in Texas where he was attending a party. When he did not come down to breakfast, his room was checked and he was found to have died in his sleep. While the cause of death is not yet confirmed, authorities have indicated that Scalia is believed to have died of natural causes. His sudden passing leaves the Supreme Court with the prospect of deadlocking 4-4 on pending decisions in several major cases. Any votes cast by Scalia prior to his death on rulings not yet published by the court will not count, per the law. In a tie vote, the lower court's ruling would stand. Many landmark cases have been decided by the current Supreme Court by a slim one-vote margin, including the controversial Citizens United decision that allowed unlimited corporate and super PAC funding of campaigns, and also the case that legalized same-sex marriages. Justices are appointed for life, unless they retire, so for both conservatives and liberals, this is a high-stakes battle for the philosophical soul of the nation's highest court for potentially decades to come. Several major cases are pending now before the High Court, including a challenge to President Obama's immigration policy, a suit that could redefine the meaning of one person, one vote in elections, a challenge to abortion access, and a public employee union's case involving the California Teachers Association. Court analysts predict these cases will likely deadlock, essentially resulting in wins for progressives, since the lower court in those cases had sided with liberals. But a case that challenges affirmative action could be won by conservatives now, since liberal Justice Elena Kagan has recused herself due to a conflict of interest. If the Senate fails to confirm an appointment, that would leave the High Court likely deadlocked on important cases for nearly a year. The newly elected president would then make the appointment, potentially, President Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders if Democrats win, or if Republicans prevail, a President Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, or one of the other GOP candidates still vying to win in the primary. A smooth path to a Supreme Court nomination could remain challenging, however, even for a new president, depending on whether the elections result in a Senate controlled by the same party as the new president or by the opposition.
A ballot measure backed by Governor Jerry Brown would make it easier for nonviolent prisoners to win parole. It's called the Public Safety and Rehabilitation Act. But now the California District Attorney's Association has filed a lawsuit asking a court to block the measure, claiming amendments added that address juvenile crimes amount to a whole new initiative. The initiative would reverse what the governor has called unintended consequences of the three strikes law that he signed into law back when he was governor decades ago, an action that left some facing life behind bars even for relatively minor offenses. Brown called prosecutors' efforts to block the new initiative perplexing. If a judge allows the measure onto the November ballot, voters would decide whether judges, not prosecutors, should have the final say on whether a juvenile will be prosecuted as an adult or as a minor. The state could save hundreds of millions of dollars in incarceration costs if the measure becomes law. If the court blocks Brown's amendment, the governor would have to file his proposal as a new initiative, requiring the signature gathering process to start over again. This is Leon Thompson on East County Magazine.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
Should teenagers be allowed to vote? Assemblywoman Lorena Gonzalez thinks so, at least in some cases. Last week, the San Diego Democrat held a rally at the state capitol steps to announce that she has introduced an amendment to California's constitution that would give 16 and 17-year-olds the right to vote in their local high school board and community college district board elections. She says these young adults are directly impacted by decisions made by local education boards and deserve to have a voice, especially in families where the students represent the first generation of voters. She adds, they're ready to be heard, and their school board representatives should be ready to listen. Also speaking at the rally were co-authors of the Vote at 16 proposal, or Assembly Constitutional Amendment 7, along with educational leaders and representatives of minority groups. Opponents have voiced concerns over whether 16-year-olds are mature enough to make important decisions. Some Republicans have criticized the plan as a ploy by Democrats to boost voter turnout among minorities, core Democratic constituencies, the San Francisco Chronicle reports. But other experts believe boosting voter turnout is a positive idea. Kim Alexander, a president of the California Voter Foundation, a nonpartisan group that works to improve the election process, has said the proposal could instill lifelong voting habits. Some research backs up that idea, suggesting that allowing 16-year-olds to vote to lead the greater civic engagement and discussions with families at home would increase voter turnout overall. In 2014, United Nations called for countries to increase efforts to engage young people in the democratic processes. Alaska, Arizona, New Mexico, and Washington have all considered proposals to lower the voting age. Two cities in Maryland, Tacoma Park and Hyattsville, have succeeded in lowering the voting age by amending their city charters. And in 2013, the turnout of newly enfranchised voters in Tacoma were nearly double the turnout of voters over age 18. Luis Vivero, a high school student, thinks students should have the right to vote on these making decisions about their schools. "We are not only the leaders of tomorrow, but the leaders of today," he stated at the Capitol rally, adding, "We are the next visionaries of the world." Although youths like Luis are directly impacted by decisions of school board members, students must rely on their parents to vote for these officials. But many students who are U.S. citizens have parents who can't vote. As a result, students whom society has deemed responsible enough to drive, work, and pay taxes are left without representation in decisions which impact their daily lives in school. Thus, local decisions may be neglecting a significant part of the community, Gonzalez concludes. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
The La Mesa City Council will hold two meetings to discuss the future of La Mesa, one at Parkway Middle School and the other at Maryland Avenue Elementary School. The Parkway Middle School meeting will be held in the school's auditorium in La Mesa on Tuesday, February 16th at 6:30 p.m. The meeting at Maryland Avenue Elementary will also be held in the school's auditorium in La Mesa on Thursday, February 18th at 6:30 p.m. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Liz Alpert.
Would you like to get warnings before a major earthquake hits and help scientists monitor earthquake tremors? There's an app for that. It's called MyShake, created by UC Berkeley researchers. Consider this. There are only 400 seismic monitoring stations in the entire state of California, but there are 16 million smartphones, making the potential usefulness of a quake monitoring app earth-shaking, literally. To download the app on your cell phone, you can visit myshake.berkeley.edu. So how does it work? The app runs using sensors in smartphones that detect movement. When a tremor occurs, it will relay that info back to scientists at the Berkeley lab. Since small tremors often precede a major quake, MyShake can also send text messages to people on their cell phones warning them moments before a major quake occurs, providing precious seconds for you to brace yourself or take cover. The app could also prove useful in parts of the world with no seismic measuring network, such as Nepal, site of a devastating quake last year. The app can distinguish between ordinary shaking of a phone and actual earth tremors with 93% accuracy. Currently, MyShake is available only for Android smartphones, though an iPhone app is under development. The app runs continuously in the background, but won't drain a phone's batteries and could help save lives when the next big quake strikes California. This is Leon Thompson for East County Magazine on KNSJ.
Voters in the city of San Diego will decide in November whether the minimum wage should be raised for all workers within the city limits. The city council voted to place the measure on the June primary ballot after opponents collected enough signatures to force a public vote. If approved by voters, the measure would raise the minimum wage to $10.50 an hour right away and $11.50 an hour on January 1st, 2017. The measure would also give workers 40 hours of sick time each year. The measure would provide raises to an estimated 172,000 city residents and sick leave to 279,000 workers if approved. Supporters say the measure will not only help workers, but boost the local economy by giving workers more disposable income to pump back into the economy. Opponents contend that the initiative would hurt businesses. However, particularly small mom-and-pop companies are already struggling to compete. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Tasha Matthews.
Heart attack is the leading cause of death in the nation, but not in San Diego. In the United States, about 610,000 people die of heart disease every year. One of every four deaths, and another 130,000 die because of stroke, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Locally, heart disease fatalities have dropped in the past few years and are now the second leading cause of death in the region. Stroke deaths have also experienced a slight decline. In 2013, a total of 4,831 people died from diseases of the heart and another 1,114 from stroke, the fifth leading cause of death in San Diego. High blood pressure and cholesterol levels and diabetes increase a person's risk of heart disease and stroke, says Wilma Wooten, the county public health officer. You can help prevent these and other chronic diseases by eating healthy, exercising on a regular basis, and managing any medical conditions you may have. In San Diego County, cancer is the number one killer. Locally, there are three behaviors: poor nutrition, lack of physical activity, tobacco and substance abuse that lead to four chronic diseases: cancer, heart disease, and stroke. Type 2 diabetes and lung disease. Combined, these diseases cause more than 50% of deaths in the region. So what are the warning signs of a heart attack and stroke, and what should you do if you or someone you know is experiencing them? Well, when it comes to a heart attack and stroke, every second counts. Wooten added, people should call 911 immediately. It can be a matter of life or death. Here are the warning signs of a heart attack. In most cases, discomfort occurs in the center of the chest that lasts more than a few minutes. Discomfort should go away and come back. It can feel like uncomfortable pressure, squeezing, fullness, or pain. Symptoms of a heart attack can include pain or discomfort in one or both arms, the back, neck, jaw, or stomach. Shortness of breath, with or without chest discomfort, can also be a sign of a heart attack. So can breaking out in a cold sweat, nausea, or lightheadedness. In addition to learning the signs and symptoms of a heart attack, it is important to also learn cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or CPR, a life-saving technique used when someone's breathing or heartbeat has stopped. If you or someone near you is having a stroke, it is extremely important that you act fast and call 911 immediately. FAST is an easy way to remember the sudden signs of stroke and stands for face. Is the side of the face droopy or is it numb? Is the smile uneven? Arm and leg. Is there weakness, numbness, difficulty walking? Speech. Is there a slurred speech? Does a person have difficulty speaking? Time. Time is critical. If you notice any of these symptoms, call 911 immediately. Knowing the risks and signs of a stroke can make the difference between life and death. For more information about heart disease and stroke, visit the American Heart Association or the CDC website. This has been Leon Thompson with the Health Report on East County Magazine.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. My very special guest today is Don Axe, and Don is the owner of Valley View Urban Farms in Spring Valley, and he's going to be telling us all about urban farming and homesteading, even in a small space, as we work to get back to our agricultural roots here in East County. Don, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Miriam. Nice to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. Now, listeners, a lot of you may not know that according to the Farm Bureau here in San Diego County, we have more small family farms under 10 acres than any county in America. That's right, more than Iowa or Kansas or Nebraska or anywhere else. So, Don, just how small is your urban farm?
Well, our urban farm is on a half an acre, and a lot of it is a slope. So we have maybe a quarter of an acre that we do all of our farming on.
Yeah, it's amazing. I was out and visited this, and I was just so impressed with how much you've been able to accomplish in a small space. So let's talk about, you know, some of the things you do there. But first, can you tell us a little bit about your background? How did you get into this?
Well, I was kind of born into it. My grandparents had a 20-acre farm up in Escondido, and they raised cows and horses and planted a lot of vegetables. So I couldn't wait to get up there and spend the summer with my grandparents growing up. And so it's kind of born into me, and enjoy doing it my whole life, off and on. So I've been able to start this urban farm here in Spring Valley and be able to provide for family with organic products and some
extras to sell, as well as classes that you teach. And we'll be talking more about that in a minute. But first, tell us about the hydroponics. For those who aren't familiar with it, you raise vegetables and fruits both via hydroponics, which is essentially in water, and also soil grown in raised beds. What's involved in getting started in the hydroponics, and why do that? It seems a little bit counterintuitive since we're in a drought. How does that work?
Well, typically a hydroponic system will save about 95% water use over a ground or soil garden. So a lot of evaporation goes on with the soil But with the hydroponics, it's pretty much a closed system. So we'll start for our seedlings and put them in our hydroponic system. And within a month, they're completely grown and ready for harvest compared to...
Yeah, you were using what they call a floating bed for this?
A floating mat system where it's insulation, a mat of 4x8 floating mat on about 6 or 8 inches of water.
Mm-hmm. And how big is the raised bed?
It's before 4 feet by 8 feet. Mm-hmm. So we can typically grow about 60 heads of lettuce in that area within a month.
Wow, that's amazing.
So very fast. We don't have to worry about weeds or gophers.
Instant salad bar.
Yes.
Okay. Now, in addition to that, you also have vegetables and fruits even growing in raised planter beds and just about everything else. Tell us about where you get your materials to build the beds from.
Sure. When I started this, I didn't have much money because 2008 came and I had a construction-related industry that was not going to be staying alive. So I was looking around to be able to start growing some things for our family and providing a healthy food for us. Mm-hmm. So a great source was a free list on Craigslist. So I would gather products and different things that people were getting rid of and mm-hmm. not wanting to use. Also, there were a lot of homes in foreclosure where people were having to get rid of their animals and cages and different things like
wow.
that. So I kind of gleaned off the land and yeah. everything at the farm is made of repurposed material.
Now, we're recording this in February, listeners. I was out there in January and you had red ripe strawberries. Eat your heart out, East Coast folks, in the middle of the blizzard while we were out sampling strawberries.
Right. Yeah, that was in a vertical growing system that we mm-hmm. had, basically a trash can with slices cut in the side around, and the strawberries would grow out of it.
Yeah, very innovative. Now, speaking of animals, you've also got all kinds of farm animals out mm-hmm. there in that small space. Tell us a little bit about what you have.
Well, we have dairy goats, 3 female dairy goats, Beverly, Katie, and Sadie. Mm-hmm. We also have chickens that we raise for eggs.
Yeah, all different kinds. How many mm-hmm. different types of chickens do you
have? We have about 8 or 10 different breeds, mm-hmm. Quite a variation of color and color of eggs. We'll get pink and blue and green and
wow.
brown and white.
So Easter's
so.
Coming up, listeners. You don't have to dye the eggs. Just get some chickens that lay them in colors. How interesting. Mm-hmm. You also have ducks and turkeys, I understand.
Ducks, turkeys, rabbits. The rabbits that we raise are Flemish Giant. Rabbits.
Adorable. How big is the Flemish Giant?
One of them is about 20 pounds. The world record right now for a Flemish Giant is 55 pounds.
Oh, my goodness.
So that's quite the rabbit.
You sell those for pets if people want?
They make incredible pets. They're very docile. They get very large. And a friend of ours has one of them that we sold to them, and mm-hmm. the rabbit sleeps with a girl at night in
oh,
the bed.
Goodness. And gorgeous. And they don't bark? And they don't scratch?
No. They do chew on wires, though.
Uh-oh. We've got to watch that. Yeah. But they're adorable. You also had a pot-bellied pig out there.
Right. Her name's Piglet, mm-hmm. and she's our little farm pig. She'll greet you at the gate looking for food mm-hmm. and follow you around,
yeah.
make sure you're doing everything that you need to do. So she's quite the funny pig. So.
Now, those of us that work in regular jobs talk about bringing home the bacon, but you really do that. I understand mm. you have a second farm out in Hamul that's, about 3/4 acre?
Yeah, about an acre that we use. We also raise organic free-range chickens and free-range pork there.
Mm-hmm.
We do all the processing ourselves. When we process bacon, sausage, ham, we don't use nitrates or nitrites to preserve them. So it's
wow.
do our own smoking.
Mm-hmm.
So they are good, healthy meat, and a lot of people are very impressed by them.
Yeah. And then right there at your backyard in Spring Valley, you've got a barn, and you do cheese making, as well as other products from the dairy goats that you raise
right.
from the milk. What else do you make?
Right. Well, we start off with the milk. Of course, it's all organic milk, so it's very healthy,
mm-hmm.
Which we do sell by the quart. And we process the milk into cheese, lotion, soap, ice cream.
Mm.
That's about all we'll use for. So
wonderful. I know my mother was raised on a farm in Texas years ago, and it's really a set of skills that have been lost largely in today's generation of kids growing up. But in her day, she said they raised absolutely everything they needed. They only had to go to town to buy coffee and sugar. Are we kind of seeing a reversal back to that trend, a little bit of interest in the new generation wanting to learn how to live off the land again, Don?
Yeah, I would hope to see that. We've come to a point where everything is so fast food and organized that's in a lot of ways unhealthy ways. So my focus has been providing healthy food and teaching people how to raise that themselves.
And yeah, speaking of the teaching, you do all kinds of classes out there at Valley View Urban Farm. Mm-hmm. Tell us some of the things people can learn if they sign up for the classes.
Sure. Our most popular one is cheese making. We'll learn to milk the goats right before we make the cheese. And within 2 hours, you'll come and make 3 different kinds of cheeses. And you can take home a product and samples and learn how to do that and do it yourself.
That sounds delicious. Mm-hmm. You also teach classes in canning. You know, you can't eat all those vegetables all in one fell swoop in the season, right. So you can save some for the winter months.
Sure.
Fermenting. Tell us about that.
Fermenting class is very interesting. You'll learn how to make sauerkraut, which is one of the healthiest probiotic foods that you can eat when it's made by yourself.
Yeah.
It's a lot more healthy because there are no other additives that people put in.
So, bread making, where do you get the grain?
We buy organic whole wheat. We grind it ourselves. It's also in a class, learn how to make bread. Mm-hmm. Sourdough bread is our specialty, which is in these days gluten-free because the fermentation eats up the gluten in the sourdough bread. So it's very good for people that are gluten intolerant.
Very nice. And then you teach people how to raise chickens and goats and pigs and all of these other animals we've been talking about also, I presume?
Correct. Yeah. All the intricacies that goes into taking care of these animals and keeping them healthy and productive for their lives and giving them a great life.
Also soap making and lotion making.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
We do specialized different types of lotion, which are all made from goat milk, as well as the soaps.
Very good. I understand you also have some construction classes geared toward folks that may be doing a little bit of farming and want to learn how to make things. Tell us about that.
Sure. My background has been in construction for a long time as well as culinary, but I was very interested in alternative building practices. So we have classes in straw bale building and cordwood building, and I've also built a lot of log homes.
Wow.
So that's not too many around here.
Fabulous. And people can also find you teaching in some of our county libraries.
Right. The county libraries have contracted with me to come and teach different classes.
Very cool.
The Crest Library, the Ramona Library.
Yeah. So you can check the San Diego County Library schedule to get the latest classes coming up, listeners.
Correct.
Now, we've saved the best for last. I'm sure a lot of you are wondering, how on earth do you do all this stuff in such a small space? Again, this half-acre farm in Spring Valley and a one-acre one out in Jamul. You can learn more at valleyviewurbanfarm.com, but also very soon, Don is going to be hosting a segment coming up for us on the East County Magazine radio show called Backyard Homesteading.
Correct. Looking forward to sharing my knowledge and wisdom about different things that I've learned and being able to pass it on to you and encourage you to do the same.
Very good. Don, I want to thank you for joining us today on the East County Magazine show on KNSJ. And we're going to end, listeners, by playing the intro to our upcoming backyard homesteading segment that Don Axe is going to be generously hosting for us. So listen up.
Hi, this is Don Axe at Valley View Urban Farm, your host of the Backyard Homestead, your how-to source for urban farming, homesteading, even in a small space, and getting back to our agricultural roots.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm speaking with Joyce Strand, author of Hilltop Sunset, the first of a new series about a financial guru transitioning from executive to winemaker. My guest has written 3 previous mysteries on message, open meetings, and fair disclosure. She also writes and publishes a blog, Strand's Simply Tips. and she's a reporter for a regional wine magazine. Welcome, Joyce. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thank you so much, and also thank you so much for doing Bookshelf. It's awesome that local authors have a place where they can talk about their books, and thank you for featuring me.
You're welcome. No one's ever said that on my show. I appreciate that. Okay, let's begin with your new series. Your protagonist, Bryn Bancroft, is a minor character from your three mysteries. Tell us about those mysteries. And what made Bryn branch out into her own story in Hilltop Sunset? Give us some perspective.
Okay. Well, first of all, the first three mysteries featured Gillian Hillcrist as the protagonist. Gillian was a public relations executive at a Silicon Valley company, which has a familiar ring to it because, yes, indeed, that's what I did for almost 30 years.
What a coincidence, yes.
But at any rate, she encountered a variety of crimes in these three books, but always there and always present was her boss. And her boss was Bryn Bancroft, who was the chief financial officer at the company where Gillian worked. And as Gillian became more pulled into the mystery, so did Bryn. And so Bryn always had a role in helping Gillian solve the mysteries. Mm-hmm. But she also, in the third book in particular, gets really involved as a victim as well. And so she was just crying out. She had her own personality, which we discover very early on in the first book when Bryn accidentally walks in on her and the CEO doing the baddie. And so we learn really quickly about Bryn's character, which evolves over those three books and then definitely morphs into a new character in Hilltop Sunset. But she absolutely is a character worthy of being a protagonist.
She demanded a book.
She demanded it, yes. Absolutely.
Well, I'm interested, now you said that you were a public relations executive. You worked in biotech and high-tech companies in Silicon Valley. But unlike Gillian, your protagonist from the first three mysteries, you never encountered murder, right?
Right.
So why murder?
True enough.
What is it that you enjoy about writing murder mysteries? And what's challenging about it?
Well, first of all, I think I started reading mysteries myself when I was a teenager, maybe younger. I can't remember when I read my first Nancy Drew, but for sure, I have read mysteries all my life. Okay, I've read other stuff too, but mysteries are my favorite.
Yeah.
When it came time after my most recent layoff, which happens in Silicon Valley a lot, I got to the point where it was difficult to find a job, and I was sitting around moping. My now late husband said, well, why don't you write a book? And I said, well, what do you mean write a book? And I'm thinking he wants me to write nonfiction, which is what I've done throughout my career, written various articles about biotech and high tech and whatever. But he says, nah, write a mystery. You read enough of them. And so that's literally how it got started. And then trying to figure out, well, what am I going to write? Okay, I've read a lot of mysteries, but how do I create a mystery? And so I looked around and I thought, well, I don't know. And I read a few newspapers because that's what you do when you're in public relations. You read a lot of publications. And I saw, my goodness, there's a lot of crime in California. So I figured, you know, that's where I'm going to get my stories. All of my stories are pulled from real crimes that happened and have happened in Silicon Valley.
Really?
And in fact, some of the perpetrators are still in prison, doing time for their crime. But that was how I evolved my plot, if you will, my story. Mm-hmm. Now, the challenge then becomes, well, you don't know anything about mysteries or solving murders or even what happens with the murder.
You're not a detective.
So I'm not a detective. So how do I make it credible? And I looked around and I found out that I had several friends among my list of friends who were policemen. And I also found a retired FBI agent who actually gave me the plot for Hilltop Sunset. He recommended it, and it was a case that he worked on. So that helped me. That challenge was met by reaching out to real experts in the field who could help me make sure that my police procedure was credible. Example, I had a police officer, detective, show up in the first two books anyway, to help solve that mystery. Well, it turns out that in San Francisco, they don't call their detectives detectives. They call them inspectors.
Yeah,
and they're one of the few.
Yeah.
And they're one of the. It's a minor detail, but it does add to the credibility.
Sure. So, can you tell us very briefly the real story of the crime that you based your new book on?
Oh, if I do that, it'll be a spoiler.
Yeah, okay, let's not have a spoiler. Okay, how about this? I know that you're a wine connoisseur. Your new book is set in California wine country, and you write for a wine magazine. Tell us what you love about California's wine and wine country, and how do you do your research for that?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure connoisseur is the right word. I certainly do drink a lot of wine. We'll get a wine lover. Yes, I'm a wine lover, I guess. It's interesting. I grew up in a household that we probably didn't drink wine. In fact, I know we didn't drink wine, and more or less probably because it was too expensive. And I came from the East Coast and got married and moved to California. I moved to California at a time when the state wine industry was just beginning, particularly Napa and Sonoma, just beginning to be famous and well-regarded. So living in the San Francisco Bay Area at the time, that's the wine I drank. That's how I learned to drink wine, was Napa Sonoma. All of the names that are famous now were just coming along then. Well, then we moved to Ramona. And we moved to Ramona in 2007, just as Ramona was starting to do its wine industry. And so I watched and have participated and enjoyed watching the Ramona wineries grow. You know, there's now 26 tasting rooms in Ramona. I have to say that. My winery friends will get on me. And the wine is superb, and it's growing. The industry's growing. You can go out and taste at a beautiful setting. And so, yes, wine has become a part of my living, part of my life. And it is such fun to move out of the corporate environment, which is where Jillian Hillcrest was, and this is another reason I wanted Bryn, and move into the winemaking industry and start thinking about, well, how do you make wine? And yes, I do need to do research.
And you go to the wineries to
do
your research.
I go to the wineries.
Fun.
I mean, I don't want to make a silly mistake like explaining why you would do stainless steel instead of oak barrels, which any novice might know. So, yes, I am, and I'm doing more research as we get into the Bryn books because she becomes more and more experienced with making wine.
It sounds like fun.
Oh, it is. Love it.
I know that you're currently working on the second Bryn Bancroft mystery, but you're also writing an historical novel about a judge in 1939 California. Give us a hint about which judge this is and what real-life event you're dramatizing for us.
Actually, I'm very excited about this. It's a book that I've been wanting to write ever since I started writing it, but because I set it in a 1939 Ventura, by the way, Ventura, okay, California, I needed to do a lot of research, and I spent a lot of time up in Ventura at their museum library doing research. I've read all newspapers, daily newspapers from 1939 to get a feel for that, that time period. But it's based on a memoir of the grandfather of a friend of mine, and he brought it to me. And this was a judge. The memoir actually ended in 1942, although he became a Superior Court judge then and then continued on for another 20 years. And it's based on his life, but it is fictionalized. The cases that I pull in are some of his own that he actually did as a lawyer as opposed to a judge. He was very careful not to talk about his cases as a judge, as you can imagine. So it is based on his values. Some of the cases are from him, but it's a story about a fictionalized story of one of his cases that involves a witness at his trial who is actually a 16-year-old precocious wannabe writer. And the two of them team up because this particular judge was very much into juvenile rehabilitation as opposed to juvenile punishment.
Interesting.
And so the values that are espoused for this particular judge, the fictional character, are the values of my friend's grandfather, but it's not really him.
Right.
But it was interesting to figure out how to write a book when you couldn't say that they had a cell phone to check on or an internet to,
very
to find
different
information.
Very so, different.
But and a different kind of challenge.
But it inspired you.
Right. That book should come out in mid-year.
Well, that leads to my last question. When should we expect to see the sequel to Hilltop Sunset?
The second of the three, I'm doing three books in that series, should come out in November of 2015, this year. And I do want to add that I am introducing a character from Ramona, who will be a minor character in the next two Bryn Bancroft books, but then I will spin her off into a series, and they will be set in Ramona.
They're all demanding, aren't they?
Yes, they are. They are very demanding. Yes, indeed.
Well, Joyce, our time is up, but thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. And again, thank you for doing this.
For more information on Joyce Strand and her work, please visit her website at joycestrand.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This is Miriam Raftery with a weather report from KNSJ. You can expect some very warm weather through Tuesday due to a Santa Ana pattern that's developing across our region. Temperatures will be as much as 20 degrees above normal for this time of year. That includes temperatures up to 90 degrees in parts of East County and into the mid to high 80s even on the coast. If you have outdoor plans, be sure to stay well hydrated and take frequent breaks in the shade.
A baseball player from Santee will be soon going to bat to raise money for patients with Lou Gehrig's disease. Mark Soles lost his mother, Carol Wall, to amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS, better known as Lou Gehrig's disease. She died March 1st of 2010. So this March 1st, Soles will embark on a 3,200-mile walk for ALS across America, starting at Petco Park in San Diego. Soles grew up in Santee, where he played baseball at Santana High School. Later, he played on San Diego State's baseball team and went on to play minor league baseball with the Chicago Cubs before moving on to careers in construction and acting. Now he's stepping up to the plate to help raise money for ALS patients. He expects his cross-country walk will take 7 to 8 months. He aims to end his journey at Yankee Stadium in New York, former home to baseball great Lou Gehrig, just in time for the 75th anniversary of Gehrig's death. Gehrig lost his life to ALS, and the neurodegenerative illness became known as Lou Gehrig's disease in his honor. Soul writes on his website, "I heard about Lou Gehrig's disease, but prior to my mother being diagnosed with it, I really had no idea what it was." Carol Wall was an active senior who even competed in the Miss Senior California pageant the year before she fell ill while on vacation. Her first symptom was slurred speech. After months of testing, she was diagnosed with ALS, and within 2 years, she was gone. Soul says he talked about the idea for his cross-country walk with his mother, who loved to travel and supported his mission. Now he'll be bringing his mother's ashes with him on his journey, and per her wishes, dropping some in every state he comes across. He'll also bring a pushcart, tent, and sleeping bag, stopping at motels along the way to freshen up. The funds that he raises will be donated to the Gleason Initiative Foundation, or Team Gleason, which provides leading-edge technology, equipment, and services to people with muscular diseases such as ALS. The foundation also helps provide extraordinary life adventures for people with muscular diseases or injuries. Soul recalls what a positive difference it has made for his mother when she received a computerized translating machine that enabled her to communicate after she lost her speech and the ability to raise her arm. He chose walking as his mode of transportation for his cross-country trek, in part because when you see someone you love start to lose that ability, it gives you a new appreciation for walking, he writes on his blog. He concludes, "It's not about the destination, it's about the journey." On March 1st, he'll be walking from San Diego through East County before crossing the county line at Ocotillo, and you're invited to join him as he walks through our region. You can learn more about this remarkable journey or donate to support the nonprofit Gleason Initiative Foundation at Soul's website. That's www.alswalkacrossamerica.com. That is www.alswalkacrossamerica.com. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is DeVario Bell.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Leon Thompson with East County Magazine. The United States Supreme Court has thrown a monkey wrench into the U.S. compliance with the landmark climate change accord signed in Paris by 195 nations, blocking a key action aimed at reducing air pollution and greenhouse gas emissions from coal-fired power plants. A cornerstone of the U.S. agreement in Paris is the Clean Power Plan that President Obama issued via executive order requiring the Environmental Protection Agency enforce emission requirements after Congress failed to take action. A Congress controlled by members who take hefty contributions from the fossil fuels industry. By a 5-4 vote, justices ordered the Environmental Protection Agency to halt enforcement of the Clean Power Plan that would have cut pollution from coal-fired power plants at least until the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals hears a suit filed by the coal industry and conservative-controlled states. The delay could kill the plan completely since a ruling by the Court of Appeals likely won't happen until after Obama leaves office. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, the environmental regulations were there to avoid thousands of premature deaths and mean thousands of fewer asthma attacks and hospitalizations in 2030 and every year beyond. The plan aimed to slash carbon dioxide emissions from power plants by almost a third of 2005 levels over the next 15 years. The Supreme Court overturned an earlier appellate court decision not to delay implementation of the program while the lawsuit worked its way through the courts. The justices voted down party lines, with all five Republicans voting to block the environmental regulations and all four Democrats indicating they opposed the majority's action. Even if the appellate court upholds the Obama administration's environmental regulations, the plaintiffs would likely appeal to the Supreme Court, pushing any final decision until 2017 or beyond. Thus, even if the plan is found to be unconstitutional, whether or not it is enforced will hinge on the outcome of the presidential election in November. The decision marks the second major ruling recently in which the high court sided with the coal and oil industry over environmental actions taken by the Obama administration. Last June, the court majority voted to block federal regulations aimed at cutting mercury pollution from fossil fuel power plants.
In preparation for a potential ballot measure to fund transportation projects and other important regional infrastructure, SANDAG, the San Diego Association of Governments, is asking the public to share your priorities for our region's future. You're invited to take a quick survey to identify the types of projects and programs that are most important to you. You can choose from transit, highway, active transportation, water quality, city projects, habitat conservation, and other categories, as well as share any additional ideas you may have. To take the survey, you can visit SANDAG.org/priorities. That's SANDAG.org/priorities. This has been a public service announcement from SANDAG, reported by East County Magazine on KNSJ.
This is Richard Faust with an education report. The California Faculty Association's union has voted to go on strike at all 23 California State University campuses unless a 5% raise is approved. CSU administrators have offered a 2% raise, but union leaders say that's not enough, since members have had no raise for 5 years from 2008 through 2012. And in 2013 and 2014, they received raises of just 1.3% and 1.6%, respectively, with no raise in 2015. The union and administration have been deadlocked since June on the pay raise issue. A strike, if called, would cover 5 days, April 13th through 15th and April 18th and 19th. And that would include professors, lecturers, coaches, counselors, and librarians at San Diego State University and Cal State San Marcos. The Sacramento Bee reports that other campus unions have indicated a willingness to also walk out in solidarity if the Faculty Association goes on strike.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Corey Clement, Royalty Free Music, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.